This project that we're going to talk about is based on the book. Obviously, you have the flyer there. It's called Preparing Today's Students for Tomorrow's Jobs in Metropolitan America. And we received funding to help support the project from the U.S. Department of Education's Institute for Education Sciences. As part of the project, we involved a number of our doctoral students in really thinking about what the nature of research is in various aspects of this problem. So we'll incorporate that as we go through the conversation. So I'm going to begin by telling you some about the context and why we decided to approach this topic and how we structured the book. And then Alan's going to talk specifically about his chapter in the book. I'll conclude with some conclusions and recommendations, and then we'll open it up for conversation. One of the issues in the United States that's receiving a lot of attention is the changing nature of the workforce and the ways that the jobs that are being created are requiring more and more levels of education. Here you can see a pretty dramatic change. So in 1973, about three-quarters of the jobs that were available required no more than a high school education, and now down, even so projected here, just 41% were available. So a pretty dramatic decline, and that trend is increasing over time. So people are talking about how some college, not necessarily a degree, is increasingly important. That conclusion about the changing nature of the job requirements is consistent with what we would expect to see if that were really true in terms of returns in the labor market. So here you can see the trend lines and average earnings based on the highest level of educational attainment that people have received. This gap, this is a bachelor's degree in case you can't read it. This is some college, high school dropouts. So folks in the U.S. who have not finished high school, their average earnings are actually declining over time. Pretty steady, no change at these levels of education, but increasing premium for those who are able to complete a four-year degree, a bachelor's degree over time. And so that just further emphasizes the benefits of going and completing college. Another important trend that's received a lot of attention in the U.S. is just the impact of education against unemployment. So it really is protection as the economy is changing. And here you can see this is not a high school graduate down to bachelor's degree. And so this is the recession. So in the U.S., there's a lot of talk right now about how with the economic downturn, college graduates are unemployed, they're not getting good jobs. But here you can see that the data show, well, yes, that's true, unemployment has been increasing with the economic downturn, but still there's clear benefit to having a college degree even when the economy has shifted. So that's one aspect of the context. So on the one hand, we're seeing data that suggest a college degree is increasingly important. At the same time, we're also seeing a number of reports that are really questioning to what extent are people who have college education really ready to do what's required in the jobs that we have today and that are being created. And we just, I'm not sure the extent to which this is the common for you, but just a lot of questioning about the readiness of workers to do jobs. And so that's, for me, it was raising this question, well, what does it really mean when we're awarding a degree? What are those skills involved? How does education really match what is being required in the workforce? Another dimension of the problem is that while people are going to college, we have a real problem in the U.S. with people finishing degrees. And here you can see that across groups, on average about 56-57% of folks who start in a four-year college complete a degree within 6 years. So these are people at a public four-year institution. And you can see the difference across groups. So generally higher degree completion rates for women than for men, regardless of race. But if you look here with blacks and Hispanics, especially low rates compared to others. Now part of why that, so this is not, there, we have an efficiency problem here, people starting and not finishing. The difference in the likelihood of realizing those benefits that I just showed you based on, because people aren't finishing, they're not realizing those benefits in terms of earnings. this translates into dramatic differences across groups, the share of our population that has a degree based on race, ethnicity, and here you can see the dramatically differences in rates of educational attainment. Substantially lower shares of blacks and Hispanics have at least a bachelor's degree in the U.S. than Asians and whites. Part of why this is important is the demographic context of our population is shifting pretty dramatically. So here you can see, this is the white population, and we're just about at the point now where whites are no longer the majority population. And the real growth here, this is the green, is Hispanic. And if you recall from the last slide, that's poorly performing. So we have some issues in the U.S. that we're trying to figure out. And that's part of the context of the group. So educational attainment, on the one hand, really seems to matter in terms of earnings and employment. We have lower rates of attainment for the fastest growing groups, but also still questioning, well, what is the value of a degree anyhow? And so that context led forms the foundation of the study and the book that we put together. So the book is designed to address three questions. First, how should we define and measure workforce readiness? Second, what are the roles of different educational sectors in providing the necessary education and training in the U.S.? And part of the issue in the U.S. is we have so many different types of educational providers. It's one of the strengths of our system. It's very large. It's very diverse. But it also makes it hard to understand, well, what is the role of particular sectors in this issue? And third, what are the most effective institutional programs and public policies for really encouraging the connections between educational preparation and work? So the book is organized along those three questions. Alan's chapter is first. And these three chapters really are around understanding what we mean by workforce readiness. And you can see here that this is the sort of the nature of it. That second chapter is by a team of students led by a faculty mentor, really taking a look at, well, what's the quality of the research that's being done on this issue and really providing a helpful critique that way. The second part is really focusing on those different educational sectors. So what's the role of career and technical education that happens largely in the U.S.? It happens in high school. What's the role of the four-year sector? What's the role of the community college sector? And one of the sectors that's growing fast in the U.S. is the for-profit sector. And then the third part is around thinking, well, what do we know from research about which institutional practices and which public policies really do make a difference? And so the first chapter is that one with the students led by a faculty mentor, really trying to critique the state of research on this topic. Ron Ferguson has a chapter thinking about the different pathways and really offering a systemic type of approach. Laura Wolf Powers and Stuart Andreessen think about regional development strategies, and Harry Holzer talks about the public policy perspective. So that's the lay of the land on this, and now I want to just turn this over to Alan so he can talk about his chapter.
The approach I've taken to this is to say, what is the connection between the education that you receive and your engagement in productive enterprise, in work? And is this something that is logical, predictable, certain, or is this something that just happens by chance? And so I've addressed that question by looking at a historical perspective. So the assumptions about the connection between school and work in the 1950s to the 1970s is essentially these three assumptions, is that some education, particularly school education, was good for everybody. But only a few people needed a lot of it. And so participation in secondary schooling in some of the developed nations at the time in this period was essentially people would leave high school around age 15. And universal compulsory education was around ended around then, and varying proportions of the population would go on to some other form of structured education, be it an apprenticeship, vocational education, go on directly to the world of work, and a very small proportion would stay in a broad general academic program and be bound towards university. And university participation in this time in countries where the head of faculty comes from and where I come from in Australia was around 10% of the population was going to college, going to higher education, particularly university education. At the same time, teaching and nursing, two of the larger professions, preparation was outside the university sector. It was in teachers' colleges or in hospitals and some form of on-the-job training. At the same time as you've got this relatively low consumption of education and higher education in particular, you had a lot of differentiation and specialisation starting in the school sector. And so that it would be quite common to have schools of domestic sciences for women, technical education or vocational education for boys in particular. And the boys and girls tended to be separated from each other at age 12 and go to different schools. Single-sex schooling was relatively common. And it was also quite common to stream children according to perceived ability on some form of measurable test, Stanford BINA or something like that. And this was to make people prepare for work. I was blessed, I went to an agricultural school. Why? Well, because I was going to be a farmer. Why? Because my father was a farmer. Why was he a farmer? Well, guess what? His father was actually not a farmer. His father was a horse breaker, somebody who trained horses to be obedient. And he failed at that because one of them killed him. And so my father thought this was not a good career path. It was a risk. But, you know, at the time, the notion of being something other than what was your father was not common. It was presumed that you would follow in the footsteps. This at a time when most of the jobs in the Australian economy were not in agriculture. They were in cities. And logically, I should have prepared myself for a life of greater choices. But no, I dutifully went to agricultural boarding school for 6 years. I know how to milk a cow. I know how to pluck and kill chickens. I have all these very useful skills. Right? But this was a time when this was the nature of schooling. Right? This is what is quaintly called a manual arts class. And at agricultural school, this was a compulsory subject up to year 10. I am actually in this photograph. Believe it or not, you can study it more closely. At the year 10 examination, I sat an externally set and marked test in theory of manual arts, and I did three practical assignments, which were also marked. I got 50 out of 100 for this subject, 49 for theory. One for practical. And that was because I did attempt to make an S-hook in the forge. This is another skill that would have helped me theoretically be a farmer. But I found the errors of my ways and did not take manual arts at grade as 11 and 12. But this is the nature of schooling. It was very highly segmented. Now, what I'm talking to you about is preparation for employment. And what I'm trying to show you by talking about this in terms of the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s is that this is not a new issue, and hence the little illustration. Right? So you've got a rudimentary schoolhouse over there in the corner where the writing is on the wall, and you've got a young man looking, or not so young man, looking for a work. And this is just to show you that people have been thinking and talking about this for many years. And what this leads to is a discussion about efficiency, which Laura referred to earlier. And when you're trying to align the economy or the schools with the economy, you make some assumptions. You make some assumptions that this is that there is quite a degree of stability in the labour market, in the economy, that you can predict that there will be a demand for people with manual arts skills, with particular commercial skills, for domestic service and so on. And you get a lot of standardisation in terms of selecting students and guiding them and tracking them so they go to the right places. And people, public policy people, talk about this in terms of, also in terms of efficiency in the economy, so that you have good alignment between economic demand and what is produced by schooling. And hopefully there's also some connection between this and earnings. And this led curriculum planners to study the nature of work. And so when you look at the history of curriculum and curriculum formation from, say, 1910 through to 1950 or 1960, a lot of it is based upon task analysis. And this is an example of task analysis. What they've done is take the young woman who's preparing, doing some particular piece of processing, and they've put lights on her hands. And this shows you all of the repetition, the movements that she's made. And this is an extreme example of task analysis. But people did, this was underpinning the scientific approach to the construction of curriculum. It's based upon the notion that you can analyse work and align education towards the type of work. And this basic principle of task analysis underlies the scientific approach, the so-called scientific approach to the construction of school curriculum for 50 or 60 years. This is the human efficiency movement. The fathers and mothers of it were the people who produced the book and the film Cheaper by the Dozen, about how they raised 12 children by efficient means and task analysis. And it's a funny film if you've got nothing better to watch. But what we've discovered is that task analysis doesn't always produce a really good fit with the economy. And what you've got here, this is one of my favourite slides, that you're preparing people with knowledge and capabilities and skills that just have no logical application in the workplace. And this is particularly vivid for those of us who work in Kazakhstan, because if you go into a chemistry classroom in Kazakhstan, the periodic table is on the wall and you're expected to memorise it, all 260-something elements, right? Why? The only answer I've ever received to that question was, because you can. Now, knowing the periodic table is actually not particularly useful. Guess what? The periodic table has changed over the last 100 years as people have discovered new elements. The basic structure of the periodic table has stayed the same. Understanding the principles behind the periodic table is quite sensible. But knowing all 260, whatever it is of no great utility. The memorization is a problem. The other thing that this slide illustrates is that we are not particularly good about talking about people's competencies and skills. And that one of the problems about mismatch between work and education is that is a problem of communication between the two. And one of the ways in which we've tried to talk about improving that conversation in the last 15 to 20 years is to talk about competencies rather than skills and rather than knowledge. And we use this notion of competence, which simply means can do. You are competent at a task when you can actually complete it successfully, routinely. And we talk about competencies as a way of applying knowledge. And so we tend to talk about them as solving problems, applying mathematical and scientific ideas and concepts, working in teams, communicating across multiple groups and constituencies. Now, every one of those competencies begins with a participle. They're all about doing things. It's not problem solving, it's solving problems. It's a very active construction. And the argument is that these competencies are a much more thoughtful and systematic way of preparing people for work. Because we've come to realise that things in the economy change. That the economy evolves and the structure and nature of work changes. And therefore we need to prepare people for differences in work and the way work is organised. Because you remember that I was to be a farmer. I was to be a farmer forever. There was no notion that I would change jobs. And indeed, Uncle Colin, on my mother's side, was regarded really as quite unreliable, because he actually had changed jobs twice. And the notion that you might prepare people or prepare yourself for a job that would change, or for a career that would have multiple destinations or stopping points, was most unusual. Right? It was that in the 1950s and 60s, it was assumed that you would do one thing for most of your life, or all of your working and productive life. And we've come to realise that that is just not so. And this little illustration, which comes from the New Yorker of May 2011, if you look at if you go to Main Street or the High Street, once upon a time you would have seen all of these shops. There's a Joe's Fix-It shop, which was a general repair shop, photo shops, where you took your photos, your film, in a little round ball thing, you know, and handed it in, and a week later they gave you back the prints, right? Some of you are probably so young you've never even seen that technology. Right? Stationery supplies, you used to go and buy paper, right? In reams and things like that. And once upon a time, there was somebody whose whole job it was to arrange travel. You used to go and buy airline tickets in shops. You just don't do that anymore. Trust me. In certain parts of the world, true. But increasingly, this is gone. And the internet cafe is about to disappear. The best source for free Wi-Fi in the United States at the moment is McDonald's, which is a very interesting little diversification. So all this illustration shows is that work, the structure and nature of work changes, and it changes relatively quickly, much more quickly than we believe it changes. And it changes much more quickly than curriculum can change. Now, remember, I was a baby boomer growing up in the 50s, remote rural Australia, and I was going to be a farmer. My brother was going to be a farmer. These 72 boys who were in my grade at high school, agricultural high school, we were all going to be farmers. At the 25th reunion of the class, our entrance year, how many farmers do you think there were?
Two
is exactly right. One, Philip Alston, had just agreed to sell his farm because he'd poisoned himself with the fertilisers. He wasn't the best student that we had. And the other one was, last name was Fife. I can't remember his first name. He had just bought his farm because he'd sold his trucking business and finally had enough money to buy a farm. So we really only had one. But the official number was two. Now, this is a much more systematic approach to it instead of my sample of 72 boys. This is actually the data for US baby boomers who, at the time of this calculation, were roughly 54. And it's a bit more complex than that. And what it shows is how many jobs they had in their lifetime. And it's sorted by degree or by education. Degree or more, some college, high school, less, didn't complete high school, and the last one shows all. Roughly, the average is that most people have had 9 jobs. Now, there's some problems with some of the data because a job is defined as one sustained piece of employment with one person. So the American, it's quite common for American kids to do summer jobs because the summer vacation's relatively long. And college kids sort of work for the summer, lifeguards, camps, McDonald's, whatever. And so that all counts as a job. And if you do the same job for 4 summers, it counts as 4 jobs. So there's some distortion in here. But what that is balanced out by is that if your job changes around you by technological innovation or change in processes, it still counts as one job because you've only got one employment relationship. So roughly this chart is sort of okay. What's interesting is the people who've changed the jobs the most is the some college group. So this is people with 2-year qualifications, diplomas, certificates, associate degrees and the like. And when you think about it, those are the people who are usually ended up working in those shops that disappeared off the high street. There were jobs that required some degree of education, communication skills, and involved some sort of service relationship. But so the other thing that the chart illustrates is that this is a phenomenon that happens to pretty much everybody. There are very few people who didn't in the 0-1 group. And so how do we prepare for this? Well, firstly, there is a messaging problem. And there's a lot of... one of our colleagues, Clive Belville, who has got a very nice chapter, is a nice economist from NYU, I think?
Teachers College,
Columbia, in New York. He gets quite angry because for his estimate, for the last 2 years, the New York Times, a relatively influential newspaper, has carried consistently stories about unemployed graduates from universities. There was one again last week. And they keep on writing, you know, Mary Jane went to a 4-year college and has graduated and has been unable to get a job. She's got debt from her tuition, debt from her living expenses, and her education is just wasted and was unnecessary. And the fact is that we do know that as Laura illustrated, people who have got higher levels of education have access to a greater number of jobs in the US economy, and that is the same. It's true for most of Europe as well. If you are better educated, you have access to more jobs because the jobs that are being created tend to require higher levels of skill, and that's the thing that you illustrated. The other thing that we can see from analyses of jobs and vacancies is that the entry level of qualifications that are being used to screen people and to select people is edging up. Even if the job itself doesn't require the skill, it's still the qualification is being used to screen people and to select people. And we also find that better educated people get their first stable job, that is a job that they keep for a protracted period, a lot faster than people who are not well educated. So these are three powerful messages about why investing in high school completion and college completion is important for individuals. The other thing that I've tried to show you is that there is no fine grain alignment between education and the economy. So that highly specialised education, like my agriculture, or commercial bookkeeping, you could do bookkeeping in high school for a while, there's not a fine alignment between education and the economy, because the economy is changing so quickly. Having said that, a lot of the debate and argument about skills and the need to help young people form skills while they're at school or at college is not matched up with the practices of employers. And the best illustration of that was in the early 1980s, I was having an argument with the head of the business council, who was explaining to me that young people were coming out of university and coming out of college and out of high school, and they couldn't write. They just did not have good skills in expressing ideas in a written form. And, you know, after about 3 hours of him discussing this with me, which means I was just listening, I said to him, "Now, that is really interesting. What examples can you find in your workplace of, can I see some of the examples of written work that we should be preparing young people for?" He says, "Absolutely. I'll get back to you with that early next week." So he came early next week and he said, "You know, we actually don't require anybody to write anything. And I've checked with most of my colleagues on the business council, and most of us actually don't require writing skills at all." But the rhetoric was the young people of today were unprepared for the workplace because they couldn't write. And so it was this mismatch is a powerful element in the debate around skill formation, education, and the economy. Now, my final observation to you is that what I've tried to illustrate is that information about the nature of work and about how work is changing, and information about how we are preparing young people, is the real crucial issue between school and work in the transition from school to work. And I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Some of these conclusions are, they echo ideas that Alan just raised. So across the chapters in the book, there really is not a clear or shared consistent definition of workforce readiness. So when people talk about this idea and this mismatch between educational attainment and the educational requirements of jobs, we don't really have a clear understanding of what that means. The second is that we really do have so many different types of educational opportunities in the U.S. There's a lot going on, and the research is not clear about what the outcomes of the short-term and the long-term outcomes are of these different types of options. So we need to know more about that. There are also a lot of policies and programs that are in place that are designed to address this issue, but the quality of the research on whether particular policies and programs and initiatives works is quite mixed. So what do we know in terms of recommendations? So one is that, given that education matters, so I think that's clear from the data that I presented at the beginning and the ideas that Alan was raising, education really does matter to the economic and social well-being of people. And so just thinking of, one goal should be that we're providing a range of high-quality educational opportunities. And given the low degree completion rates and variations in college entrance and completion, the reality in the U.S., and as hard as this was for me to write, not everyone's going to earn a college degree. And so we need to think about, well, what's the value of the different educational providers that we have, and how can we ensure that those opportunities do pay off in a meaningful type of way? Now, related to that, though, is that in the U.S., we have to think more about how can we ensure that students are not just tracked into different types of options. So one, I mentioned the growth in the for-profit sector in the U.S., and that sector tends to enroll disproportionately students from low-income families and students of color, and the outcomes, on average, at those institutions are not as good as they are at other institutions. So how can we ensure that the outcomes are good, and how can we also ensure that people have equal opportunity to attend the different options that we have? In order to do that, really, though, we have to improve information, and Alan talked about this. Information really seems to be at the key. So on the one hand, we don't want to have automatic channeling of people into different paths, but if that's with that, we have to have mechanisms in place that people understand what are the different benefits associated with different educational choices, and make sure that informed choice can happen. Information matters not only in terms of the pathways that students choose, but also in terms of what we really mean in terms of workforce readiness. And I think this goes to what Alan was talking about also, just understanding. So one of the common ways of framing this is the difference between generic and specific skills. And I heard this in talking to employers in Kazakhstan. It happens in the U.S. And people are trying to, in Kazakhstan, there are different priority areas for with the Balashak Scholarship Program, which is what I'm looking at, in terms of the major fields that are required. So there's a lot of effort being placed to try to project, okay, what's the workforce really need? What are the specific benefits of specific majors in terms of workforce readiness? And I think a more comprehensive approach and more appropriate approach, given the changes in the economy that Alan talked about, is really around the competencies and a more general type of approach like that. A fifth idea that comes across in the book is really there's talk on both sides from educational providers and from employers about this mismatch between what's being provided and what's needed, but there's not really a lot of collaboration or cooperation in the U.S. anyhow. So there are some good examples about how employers might become more linked to what's happening in the classroom in various different types of educational providers in order to help better address the needs on both sides and alleviate this mismatch that both sides are talking about. Six is really, so this gets at some of the efficiency issues, the helping students to complete the programs that they start. The data for the U.S. are pretty clear that earnings, for example, increase substantially when you complete a degree. Simply just having some college helps, but the bump in earnings is much greater when you actually finish the programs that you start. And then finally, thinking about the role of public policy and trying to the role of government in creating incentives for workforce training programs, for encouraging innovation around these issues, and really encouraging greater research to really identify what works, both in the short term and the long term. I think there also has to be greater attention to what are the outcomes that we really value. So I started off by showing pretty narrow measures of the outcomes of education, earnings, and unemployment, but there are other things that we as individuals and a society care about as well.